Arizona's news station. KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
All right, we got Pamela Hughes as well as Barry Marksand holding it down for me here today. And Barry, it was about this time yesterday that Bruce and I were on the air, and this story popped up in our news feed, and it was all over the TVs that are in front of us right now. We've got these three huge flat screen TVs, and when I initially saw the headline, I was like, how is that possible? The headline, that a court rules Sandy Hook families can sue gun maker over rifle used in shooting. Then this morning, we have the horrific story out of New Zealand, where you have another mass shooting, 49 people. And guns have been called into question quite a bit, particularly in this country, especially in light of Sandy Hook, where you had those children who were gunned down at an elementary school. So we wanted to get some perspective on this. And so joining us right now on the KTAR Newsmaker line is our legal analyst, Monica Lindstrom. Good morning to you, Monica.
Good morning.
So as we are diving into this story, initially I'm like, okay, I didn't think they would be able to sue a gun manufacturer. I thought there was some protections there, but this seems to be about marketing. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. So back in 2005, Congress laid down a law that said you can't really sue gun manufacturers or hold them responsible for third parties using the guns for criminal activities. So think about it. You can't sue a gun company if someone chooses to take a gun and commit a murder. That's just not fair, is basically what Congress said. Well, this lawsuit says, okay, we know we can't do that, but essentially, what's another way to get to these gun manufacturers? And so the Connecticut Supreme Court decided, you know what? We can't go at them right the front door, right? We're going to go through a side door and say the way that you're marketing things is dangerous, it's unacceptable, it's irresponsible. So we're going to allow the victims to go ahead and sue you for your marketing practices, not because someone took your gun and did a crime or committed murder, but because of something you did that was irresponsible. And that's where we get this decision. So now the victims can turn around and try to sue the company or go forward with their lawsuit based on how they marketed their products or the guns to the public.
Monica, do you think that that's likely to be successful when it hits the federal courts?
You know, I'm not sure, because I think for a while the public and the politicians have been looking for ways to hold gun manufacturers responsible, just like the tobacco companies. And now we're dealing with the drug companies with the opioid epidemic. They're looking for ways to hold someone responsible and to make change. And I think our country might be at a tipping point with these mass shootings and just shootings in general, that perhaps things are changing a little bit, and the federal courts might turn around and say, you know what, it's time to continue this exception or to allow this to go forward. Now, I do think that Remington is going to turn around and try to appeal this to the Supreme Court, because what do they have to lose by appealing it? They don't want this decision to stand, and neither do the other gun manufacturers. So they might try to help Remington with this. So I think it's a 50-50 when it comes to the court system about whether, you know, this will go forward in the future or not.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely going to be appealing it. And they'll be, I mean, the NRA filed a brief in this case also where they said that if the court ruled the way it did, it would eviscerate the protections for the gun manufacturers. I think the question is going to be, when it gets to the federal courts, do they interpret the law the same way? Let me ask you this. Do you think that this was based on what part of the marketing in Connecticut was this based on? Do you know?
Well, it was based on the commercials that came out for the actual gun or the advertisements. And I think the example they had was a guy was with the gun. I think he was dressed in, you know, fatigues or something similar. He's in a jungle type atmosphere. And it said something to the extent, when the pressure's on, we'll be there for you, or something like that. So they're saying, look, that isn't real life. That isn't a scenario. That is a military type scenario. And you're marketing to these people that are high risk, that are in these mental spaces, perhaps, where they feel like they're under a lot of stress and pressure. And so that's almost giving them an idea. And this court is saying that's irresponsible and unethical to market that way. So it's not about staunching the sale of these guns or getting rid of these particular types of firearms. It's how are you going to market it? For example, tobacco companies, we don't want you marketing to children and using certain colors and cartoon characters, right? I think it's on that line, not so much trying to stop the sale of certain firearms.
KTIR legal analyst Monica Lindstrom, thank you so much for your time today.
All right, bye.
All right, thank you. You know, Barry, Monica brought up some really interesting points there as far as, you know, what she feels the likelihood of it, you know, succeeding on a federal level, kind of a 50-50 right now. I guess, you know, as someone who practices law as well, do you think that this could set a precedent that has other companies kind of uncomfortable at this moment?
No, this is such a different law. This law was created by Congress to really provide indemnity for these gun companies. And I'm not sure where this will end up once the federal courts get a hold of it. My guess is this won't stand. The issue is, in the meantime, can they get some discovery done? Are they able to get in there and get the documents and the emails and the communication that's internal to this particular gun company, Remington? And that's what they've been trying to hide all this time. That's really what this is about. Remington declared bankruptcy, by the way.
Yeah.
So they're not even around anymore. So or at least if they're around, they're much smaller. So I don't know what the circumstance will be overall. But no, I don't think this really affects other things like cigarettes or things like that. This was an exception written into the law, and some smart lawyers said, hey, here's some advertising. This violated the law in Connecticut, which has an unfair trade practice law there, and that's our way in. And they did that, and I think they were successful there. The question the federal courts are going to decide is whether or not that exception to the law is sufficient to bring them all the way in, to bring Remington all the way in, just based on that exception. And my guess is they're going to say no. We'll see.
You know what? The families had filed this suit, I want to say, in like November of 2017. They've been waiting a long time to get some sort of decision. It goes back to a lower court. There's a lot more that has to happen before this really has any definitive teeth to it or goes nowhere.
It's dragged on a long time. Keep in mind, this was Sandy Hook. This is 5 years ago. We just had the fifth anniversary of this.
Oh,
so
goodness.
It's dragged on because of the company's bankruptcy and because of some other issues legally that it just takes time. It's gone through this appellate process, which takes time. It's going to take a lot more time. But this is the first time ever, yeah, since 2005, when this law was put into place, that anybody has found a way to pierce or go around the indemnity for gun manufacturers. First time.
So it's a good reason to keep an eye on it because they've at least found, I guess you could say, a bit of a weakness, and they're going to see how much they can exploit it if there is anything to exploit.
Exactly.
All right. So, you know, cell phones, everybody has them. We talk on them in public. But how much privacy do you have in public? And do you really recognize what you're giving up when you talk on your phone in public and what people can learn about you? It's a really crazy assignment that some law students were given that we want to tell you about that may shift a little bit on how you are talking on the phone at lunch today.
Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Oh, man. So it is spring break. Your kid's probably off at home or at a camp or traveling somewhere. But there was an assignment that was given to some students, some law students that were studying privacy law. And after the optional assignment were given to these students, they're like, huh, that's a bit creepy. Here it is. They were told at some point on their break to go to a public place, you know, wherever it may be, and see if you can figure out a stranger, a total stranger's identity. Okay, well, how would you do that? You're just listening. All right. Based upon what the stranger says out loud, either in a conversation, at a table, or on the phone, we hear a lot of people doing that. And simply by using a Google search with what you hear, and then using some other like context clues, you know, whether their clothing, their bags, logos, things along those lines, could you figure out their identity? And Barry, yeah. A lot of these students were able to figure out who this stranger was sitting across from them in places like the airplane.
Yeah.
And places like a train. They were able to figure out a total stranger's identity.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's so much information about us online right now, and a lot of it seems incidental, right? It's the stuff you put on Facebook, the picture with you, and that says you went to this university, and you work at this job, and all that kind of stuff. And But you, it's there. So if you search for your name and you put yourself in, a lot of information comes up. You put in, you know, your name and a city or where does he live, and your house will come up. I mean, you can pull these things up. If you go buy an address, you can even just put the address in, and it tells you who owns the house.
I mean, how much they paid for
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
I mean, like all those things.
There's a lot of information out there. So this doesn't necessarily surprise me, and it's scary. It's a little creepy. There's no question about that. And I guess the issue is, how much are you going to share in public? And I think a lot of us think we walk around in this bubble of privacy rights that we have, and in reality, we don't have those rights in public. If you're out in public and you're saying stuff and people overhear you, that's just tough.
Well, you don't have that right necessarily, but I think we have a notion that it exists.
Well, we think
it's
there.
And the reason why I believe that is when I tell you, yeah, they were just supposed to listen to somebody and see if they could figure out their identity.
Yeah.
Most people go, whoa, wow, creepy. Well, you think it's creepy because you think you have some sort of privacy. When in public, you really don't. Now, most people aren't going to go around Googling people, you know, and trying to find out their identity.
Well, they are
but
now.
This, well, there you go. We give them an idea. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
But I just want to give you one example here. So one of the students at a Starbucks, he said a guy was having a fight with somebody on the phone, maybe his accountant, and he kept loudly repeating his social security number as well as his full name. After the third time he did it, I wrote it down, and I handed it to him.
It's awesome.
It's just kind of like the, duh, buddy, we can all hear you, right? So we wanted to ask you on our open mic line, 602-200-2733, what was the craziest thing you've ever heard somebody say in public? Maybe you weren't trying to figure out who exactly they were, but you kind of looked at them a little cross and go like, really, man? You're talking about that here? Do you know? I can hear you. Oh, my goodness. Take a listen to these.
Oh. Hi, this is Jennifer from Fountain Hills, Arizona. Craziest thing I ever heard somebody talking about in public on their phone was how many ounces of drugs this person allegedly sold somebody, yelling and screaming while walking through a home goods store.
Yeah. Oh, that's great.
That's awesome.
That makes a lot of sense. Let's talk about my criminal activity as I'm walking through the store. Brilliant. Oh, but not the worst.
Hello, my name is Tom. A story my wife shared with me. She was in a Bank of America one day, and somebody was very loud on their phone talking about their daughter's STD and repeated it several times. And finally, my wife said something to her. I hope your daughter gets over her STDs. Of course, the woman was very embarrassed and all that.
Oh.
But it was hilarious to think that somebody would share that out loud.
Yes.
Yeah. People think they're in a bubble. Nobody can hear them if I'm talking on the phone.
I don't know that. I couldn't go up to the woman and say anything like, oh, I hope your daughter gets over this. I look at people like, really? Like, they get the mom look for me. But I never, like, say anything. I don't know.
I usually don't say anything either. Usually it's more of, why are you talking so loud? Why do we need to hear you in public?
So annoying.
But I heard somebody once, it just reminded me of this, reading their credit card, like, loudly into their phone.
582-634.
You know, and most likely no one's there not writing it down. But my goodness, it's people just don't realize.
You don't realize it. And we have become so comfortable in our own bubbles. And I think that's exactly what it is, Barry, is that people think that they're in this own bubble, but and that nobody's listening. But they most definitely are. And there are some weird situations. Oh, my goodness. I'll share this story. So I went out to lunch. This was a couple of years ago. I went out to lunch with a girlfriend of mine, and we were at Liberty Market in Gilbert, right there off of Gilbert Road. And we're having lunch, and we're sitting at this little two-top, and my girlfriend and I are talking, and it's one of my close girlfriends. So we're talking about our lives. We're talking about our children. We're talking about our spouses. We're talking about everything, right? And it's just her and I. We were catching up. We hadn't seen each other for a couple months. You know how that goes.
Yeah.
And there was a woman sitting next to us. I mean, I knew she was there, but I wasn't paying any attention to her, right? So she gets up to leave, and she goes, excuse me. And I said, yeah. She goes, are you Pamela Hughes? Yes,
yeah,
I am.
Worst.
Hi, how are you? Right? Oh, I listen all the time. And I, you know, I love it when people say hi. You know, I think that that's fantastic. But she left. And I immediately was like,
What do we say?
What did I say? Yeah. Right? Because I'm having an intimate conversation with a girlfriend of mine.
Right.
Not aware that, like, there are all these other people around me listening.
Well, and they know who you are.
And that made it even weirder. Yes, absolutely. Hey, you know what? Yesterday, we had an amazing program. Bruce and I are quite proud of it when we dove into the issue of teen suicide. And if you missed it, it's an hour of radio you really need to go back and listen to. It made me a better mom, a better friend. And so you can subscribe to our podcast and go listen to that on your Android, on your iPhone. And whether it's that or any other show, you never have to miss it when you subscribe to the podcast. This week, it is brought to you by Stampede Plumbing. Another mass shooting. This one in New Zealand. By now, you know the details. 49 dead in two mosques. But what was different about this one is that the shooter strapped a camera to his helmet and live streamed it on Facebook. Whose responsibility is it to take that down quickly? Is it the social media's company or is it ours not to share it? We'll dive into that next here on KTAR News.
Arizona's news station, KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
By now, you know the numbers. 49 people dead at two mosques in New Zealand. What you may not know is that they're calling him a terrorist. I'll call him a monster. The guy who did it also decided to strap a camera, something to his helmet.
He put like a GoPro on.
And live streamed it on Facebook. So for several minutes, people were able to watch as this monster gunned down innocent people. And it was the police in New Zealand that called Facebook and said, you gotta take that down.
I want to point out a specific section of Facebook's statement that said New Zealand police alerted us to a video on Facebook shortly after the live stream commenced, and we removed both the shooter's Facebook account and the video. The big question here, Dana, is why did Facebook need to wait for police to tell them what was happening on their own platform?
Well, because the platform did exactly what it was designed to do. To allow us to share whatever we want, whenever we want to, with as many people as we want to. That's how Facebook is designed.
Yeah. And it's not just Facebook here. I mean, they had it up and they took it down when police had to take it down. But 8 hours after that, people were still getting it on YouTube and reposting it on YouTube. So it's other of these companies as well. I don't know how much we can expect from them, considering the millions and millions of submissions that are likely going on there every minute, if not every 10 minutes. I just don't know how much we can expect from them. But at the end of the day, isn't it up to us if we want to see it? I mean, none of us really watched that live unless we were friends with this murderer. Those of us who are seeing it now are searching it out. We're going somewhere, either trying to find it or it pops up on our feed and we watch it affirmatively. We click on something knowing what it is. Should we allow adults to look at what they want to look at when it's news? I mean, that's what this is. It's news.
Okay, but when you say it's news, it used to be that the news, think, you know, Cronkite, right? You think of the news, or even just going back to the networks, you know, ABC, CBS, NBC. You could even throw in, you know, cable. You've got, you know, MSNBC, CNN, and Fox. You're not going to see this video.
No.
On any of those organizations I've just listed. And that's the way it used to be, that the news organizations were the gatekeepers.
Right.
But Facebook has now, like it or not, become a news outlet. It's where a lot of people get their news. And there aren't any gatekeepers anymore. So who controls that content?
Well, and that's my question, is shouldn't we be allowed to control that content to some extent? Now, I don't want it out there where other potential terrorists and mass murderers are watching it and getting incentives or learning how it's done. Maybe that's the reason to take it down. But the idea to me that we're taking it down because we're too sensitive to see it, I don't think that's a good enough reason. I'll make that decision myself not to see it. I don't want to see gruesome things because I don't want that in my head. I don't want to wake up in the middle of the night remembering how I saw ISIS behead a journalist. I don't want to see that. So But I'm an adult. Let me decide. If it's news, let me decide whether or not I want to see that. And that, isn't that really where this the online community has become? We're able to get news that's not filtered anymore. It's not. It doesn't have to run through the networks before it gets to us and have them decide what we can or can't see. Should some people be allowed to see this to see how gruesome terrorism is in real life? Maybe that affects them in a way that helps get something done.
Really? You really think it affects them in a way to get something done? Well, I don't think this is impacting anybody in a way to get things done. All I got to tell you is 49 people were indiscriminately murdered, gunned down, men, women, and children in a mosque. Fill in the blanks. Yeah. I don't need to see it in order to know what has happened. And after that video is out there, you and I are not going to watch it. I have no desire. I, too, don't like to see these videos. I refuse to watch them because I, too, have those images seared into my brain. And there are things that I have seen that I wish I could unsee, but I can't. So I don't go looking for this stuff. But there are folks who watch it. And the news aspect of it that you brought up there, Barry, is part of it because the New Zealand Herald watched it. They watched it live on the live stream when it popped up. And as I'm reading an article, they start describing what they've seen.
Right.
And so while I haven't even gone out to seek it, I haven't looked for it. It didn't pop up on my feed. I'm not friends with the murderer.
Right.
I'm still running into it.
You're exposed to it.
And I frankly don't need it. I don't know what value it brings, but it does beg this question. Whose responsibility is it? Is it the social media platform, whatever it may be, Facebook, Twitter, Reddit, YouTube, whatever you want? Is it their responsibility to monitor and get rid of this content? Or is it ours not to share, seek out, or take part in? Here's what you're saying on the open mic line.
This is John from Phoenix, and I just want to shout out that not Facebook's responsibility to go ahead and censor anything put on their platform. That's more of a community's responsibility, individual responsibility, parents' responsibility to go ahead and decide what to go ahead and share, what not to share, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate. So we all have to make a decision as a community to go ahead and not share these type of videos.
I get the not share, and I would totally agree with our listener on that. But I also know how YouTube works, where you look for one thing and then another thing just starts automatically rolling, or you're in your Facebook feed and you didn't know somebody shared it and it automatically starts playing. So the fact that like it exists there increases the possibility of you being exposed to it.
Hi, this is Kyle in Gilbert. I absolutely do not want to see the video. I do think it's social media's job to scrub and keep these off. If we think video games are too violent and creating violent people today and violent kids, then having these videos readily available is much, much worse, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with that. And there's certainly a part of that that I think is valid. But just going back to something you said earlier, when you talk about whether it can make change, people who saw back in World War II, the war was presented to the American public in a movie style. It was Hollywood presented it in newsreels and other ways. We never saw the gruesomeness of war. Later in Vietnam, we saw that. We saw kids having their legs or arms blown off. We saw injured people. And I think that contributed to the anti-war movement. It contributed to people seeing what war really is and then making a decision of, do we want to be there? So there, I think there's a value in seeing the gruesomeness of things. It's not, I don't want to see it. I'm with you on that, and I don't want to share it. But I think it helps us to understand what this really is.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question as to what this really is. There's enough of that content out there right now. Whereas back in the 60s, there wasn't. This is a different day and age. This content is readily available, unfortunately.
I'll give you the quick example is, I'm forgetting his name now, but the football player who, Ray Rice, who hit his wife or girlfriend in the elevator. Before we saw the video, everybody thought it was bad, but how bad is it? You know, everybody kind of let it go. He kept playing. And then the video came out, and suddenly there's this huge uproar. He's suspended from the league.
Yeah,
but my point is, seeing something gets a visceral reaction.
I agree with you on that, but that was also, I think, the NFL trying to cover up what actually happened, and the video allowed them to be held accountable. Nobody's covering up what happened in New Zealand. We know what happened in New Zealand, and frankly, I don't think we need to see it in order to fully appreciate it. Hey, you know what? Subscribe to the Bruce St. James Pamela Hughes Show podcast. Android, iPhone. Never miss a thing this week, brought to you by Stampede Plumbing. Man, after a conversation like that, you need your faith in humanity restored.
I do.
I've got Allie from our news department popping in because there's a great story that you can help out with here in the Valley this weekend. And that's coming up next.
KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Yeah, you just heard Peter Seymour say it there. We've got the president who is expected to sign his very first veto of his presidency. Expected to be around 12:30 this afternoon. We will be carrying that live for you here on KTAR when he does. It's going to be taking place in the Oval Office. And with me right now, I've got Barry Markson. And Barry, you know, this comes a day after 12 Republicans joined 7 Democrats to push back on the president's decision to declare this national emergency down on the border. Now, the reason why those Republicans did it, not because they don't think that there's an issue down the border. I think, especially here in Arizona, we can all agree that there is an issue down on the border. What we can't seem to agree on is how to fix it. Those Republicans sided with Democrats because they see this as more of a constitutional issue and less of a border issue.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. It is a constitution. It actually is both a constitutional and a border issue. It doesn't have to be one or the other. The people supporting the president are trying to make it all about the border. But really, the border issue remains. The question is, can the president under the Constitution declare this emergency and move money around, in essence, allocate money, taking the job of the legislature?
Taking it away, yeah.
Right, and that's what he did here. So I'm very disappointed in conservative Republicans, just like I would be Democrats, if they did something that I thought was hypocritical to their normal stance on things. Republicans, for years, all we've been hearing about is the Constitution.
And
President Obama was breaking the Constitution when he did executive orders and they filed suit against him. Here you have President Trump doing more than Obama ever did, and all these Republicans voted for him. And I think the bottom line is there's 22 Republicans in the Senate who are running for re-election in 2020. And except for Susan Collins, all of them voted with the president, including Tom Tillis in North Carolina, who literally wrote an op-ed opposing what the president did and made a speech on the floor of the Senate telling his Republican colleagues why they had to vote against the president. And then minutes before the vote, he's flipped and voted with the president because they're afraid of getting primaried or losing support of the president.
And that's the thing. I mean, like, the field coming up in the next election for Senate is not as favorable to Republicans as this past cycle was. And so you've got a lot of those senators playing defense in the sense of what do they think is going to get them that seat, not necessarily what do they think is the right thing for this country. And that's the problem with politics. We've always had it, them looking out for their own best interests and not the people that they were elected to go represent. But again, welcome to politics, and hence the reason why I'm not a fan. You know what I am a fan of? Restoring your faith in humanity, because, man, you're going to need it after that. And I've got Allie Vetner from our news department that is in here right now, because, Allie, I wanted to bring you in. I thought you were working on an amazing story right here in our own community that I think is important to talk about, and it's also going to give our listeners an opportunity to restore some faith in humanity. So tell me about your story, will you?
So a few days ago, I got an email from a listener, and they had this whole flyer, press release, invitation about a woman who is a retired Glendale police sergeant, 23 years on the Glendale police force, dedicating her time to DARE, the drug unit, educating kids on tobacco, drug use, all sorts of things like that. She spent time with the Department of Homeland Security. Well, she retired early, take care of her aging parents, and also raise her 3 grandkids. Last year, she found out she was diagnosed with glioblastoma. And since then, she's been in and out of work. She's now disabled and very much so just fighting for her life.
Right. And so she has had some experiences where her body was acting a particular way. She thought at one point in time she was having a stroke.
Mm-hmm. Got home, and it was just like my body acted like it had a stroke. I couldn't move my left side. Went to the hospital. Within an hour of being at the hospital, I was talking to neurosurgeons.
So there she was, okay, going, wow, I wasn't expecting this. And she's struggling right now with not being able to do her job. She's struggling that, you know, she has helped serve her community for all these years, and now she might need a little help. So this weekend, you can give her a little help. Tell folks how they can help her out.
So this awesome local group called the Crisis 22 Project, they typically try to help veterans that are facing suicide. And I know you guys just had that big project as well about that. They are dedicating tomorrow, Saturday the 16th. They're having a poker race. And so you can either donate to it or you can participate in yourself. But it will be tomorrow morning and it'll be at the Disabled American Veterans Department of Arizona's Glendale chapter. And so all the website is online at KTR.com, but it starts at 9 a.m. And basically you can play a poker game driving around the valley with a bunch of motorcyclists and collect different poker cards. And whoever has the best hand wins. All the money is going to her and her family.
You know what? It's a great way to help somebody out who has proudly served this community, whose son is proudly serving this country. Again, all that information up there for you right now at KTAR. Allie, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Barry Markson, thank you for joining me today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Tommy Two-Tone, Why You Buggin' Over There, as well as super producer Stevie Z. Peter Seymour, sticking around.